Monsanto, DuPont, Bayer, Nestle, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, General Mills, Del Monte Foods, to name a few, are putting up about $28 million to put down California's Proposition 37 right to know about GMOs. This leads us to ask, why not know about GMOs?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 790th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Valparaiso who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Rick O'Shea on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, the giants of America's food chain are putting up about $28 million to put down California's Proposition 37 Right to Know About GMOs initiative. This two-decade-old technology of genetic engineering, as it is coming to be called, is rapidly re-engineering the business of agriculture by making it possible for people to grow plants and animals in ways not possible in nature. Let me give you two examples here. Soybeans that have been genetically engineered to withstand glyphosate herbicides like Roundup make it possible for farmers to grow thousands of acres of soybeans with no weeds and no weed hoeing. Corn that has been genetically engineered to contain the organic pesticide Bacillus thuringiensis kills insects that try to eat it, and thus farmers need not spray for pests. Since genetic engineering allows farmers to gain more control of their crops, they and the industry they support quite naturally resist anything that threatens the viability of this technology. Consumers, many of which, on the other hand, question the efficacy of eating foods that have been re-engineered to contain poison or to survive being immersed in poison, and thus have placed Proposition 37, the Right to Know About GMOs initiative, on the California budget or ballot. Producers say consumers should not have the right to know about the GMOs in their foods. Consumers say producers should tell them about the GMOs in their foods. So we ask, why not know about the GMOs? In the past, we have asked proponents of California's Proposition 37 this question. This week, we ask the opposition. And when we asked the opposition, they gave us Kent Bradford, PhD director, seed biotechnology. Oh, my goodness, we have somebody who really does know about biotechnology. And we're honored to have you here, Professor Bradford.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Seed Biotechnology Center. I have your website up here in front of me, and this looks like something I could talk with somebody about for about 53 hours because it's that interesting.
Well, we have a lot of information on our website about biotechnology, and I think if your reader or your listeners are interested, that'd be a good place to go, sbc.ucdavis.edu. In fact, I think the page that we have on biotechnology for sustainability is directly in line with your goals as well, so I would really direct people to that page as well.
Fair enough. Well, you know, give us a thumbnail of what you do with the Seed Biotechnology Center, because it really is at the heart of the food chain. It's what we do to live.
Well, our goal is, in fact, to develop new technologies, that is, use the research resources of the University of California, plant scientists here, geneticists, food scientists, post-harvest scientists. All of us are working to try to improve our food supply, make it more sustainable, make it more plentiful, lower cost, more nutritious. So we're working on all those avenues. Some of our activities are actually utilize genetic engineering, but many of them do not. That is, we're engaged in developing various types of tools that can be used by plant breeders, some of which involve genetic engineering and others do not. So our philosophy is that there is not such a sharp red line between the various technologies that are used, and that facing increasing population, climate change, and so on. We really need to use all the technologies we can.
Fair enough. Well, for 10,000 years, give or take, we've always messed with the genetics of crops because we've always wanted them to do more with less, correct? So we've always selected the best from one year's crop and propagated it for the next year's crop. What is the essential difference between that which we have always done and which you still very much are involved with at the Seed Biotech Center and genetic engineering?
Well, as you say, virtually all of our crops that we eat have been radically changed by humans over the course of domestication. So we've taken wild plants and over the course of, as you say, somewhere between 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 10,000 years, those crops have been changed, as you say, through selection, most of it in the early days, of course, inadvertent. But that's resulted in genetic changes that have resulted in our domesticated crops. Some of these changes have been so radical that, for example, it's only in the last 20 years or so we've really even discovered where common crops like corn came from. They're so changed from their wild relatives. So all of our domesticated crops have been through genetic modification in the sense that they've been changed. About 100 years ago, when the rediscovery of Mendel's laws of genetics, it became possible to be more directed in this, that is, to understand how traits are inherited and start to actually be a little more efficient in that rather than just unconsciously selecting. And then more recently, we've been able to further identify the specific genes, the specific components of the genetic information or the chromosomes that actually confer the traits that we're interested in. And now we have ways to simply move those traits into our crops to enhance their performance.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, doing what we've always been doing. But whereas before, you know, we would take a stand of corn, for example, and say, boy, this plant is much better than all the rest, and so we propagate that. We're actually now, instead of looking at the plant, we're looking at the plant chromosomes. That's not very big, is it?
Well, the chromosomes are inside the nucleus of individual cells, so you're right. cells are quite small, nuclei are even smaller, and the DNA is smaller than that, but it's quite remarkable. In every cell of your body, you have about 3 feet of DNA coiled up inside the nucleus of every cell. So it's a remarkable molecule.
So say that again now. In every cell of our body,
if you were to take the DNA, all of the DNA molecules you have in a single cell of your body, it would stretch to about 3 feet if you stretched it out. It's coiled very tightly and managed in chromosomes, but you know, there's a lot of it there.
Wow. And so that's what we're working with. That's what you're working with, right? That 3 feet of DNA rope, as it were, inside our cells.
Yeah, that's what genetics is about. That is the inheritance from one generation to the next of the genetic information that provides the information that allows a plant or an animal or any organism to develop.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, that's what we've always been working with, but though we haven't ever really been able to see it or really actually know what we're doing, that's what we've been working with, was that DNA inside of all of our cells and re-engineering them. Now, what's different? Because there is something different about genetic engineering. What is it?
Well, let's follow the progression. I think you made a good analogy of we really can't see it, and that's true. Genetics uses visible traits. That is, we see what we call the phenotype, that is, the traits that you can see, and we have to use the inheritance of those and their ratios and occurrence in the next generation to infer how they're arranged in the nucleus and in the chromosome and so on. So it's been very indirect. The next level that we're able to do now is to use markers, that is to identify map locations, if you will. If you think of the chromosome as a map, we're able to put little markers. So if you think of your Google Maps or something, we're able to put little flags on there that say this is one intersection and this is another and so on. Again, that's not genetic engineering. That's just advances traditional breeding, which I don't think anyone has real concerns about. So the difference with that, though, is that enables us to have these maps. And so just like most of us enjoy having a phone or a Garmin or something, a GPS that will help us find our location, these tools are very helpful for locations are the traits that they want and help them move them around. The next level, as you say, is genetic engineering, where...
Can you hold that? We're going to have to take a quick break. So on the one hand, we have the phenotype, which is simply the expression of our genetic makeup. It's what we look like. It's what our plants look like. It's how we respond to the environment and to our world. But what we're working with now is the genotype themselves, the actual genes, correct?
That's right. I mean, what genetic mapping enables breeders to do is, the analogy is somewhat like medicine before x-rays.
Just a sec. We have to go to the break, but boy, it's getting exciting, folks. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We've got Dr. Kent Bradford, Director, Seed Biotechnology Center. Why not know about GMOs? Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, for 10,000 years, we have taken the phenotype of our crops, our plants and animals, which is how the visible reflection of how those plants respond to the environment. We've selected from the favorable characteristics, and then in doing so, we have re-engineered the genes or the genotype of those crops and those plants and animals. But now, we have come to a place in our history where we've gotten very clever, because we've actually mapped the DNA inside of each cell. And we know where things happen, which is very interesting if you want to really make changes. And is that, are we headed down the right road, Dr. Bradford?
Yeah, I think you're right. As I was saying, the ability now is that we have with genetics is somewhat like they have with medicine, when we now have x-rays and MRIs and so on, where the doctor doesn't just have to ask you about your symptoms, it can actually look and see what's going on. And then further, I guess genetic engineering, you could say in that analogy, would be similar to then saying, oh, I do see something there, and we have a surgery where we can correct that. So that's pretty much what it means.
So in essence, we've really become proficient at managing the genes of living things.
Well, we're becoming more proficient all the time. This is what I would say. I wouldn't say that we can totally do anything that some people can imagine. I've seen things stated in comments that are really not feasible and not desirable.
Sure.
But
sure.
We're getting better grasp on it all the time.
Okay, good. Now, I guess what's really fascinating to me is we now seem to have the ability of grafting or of taking the genes from one species and inserting them into the genes of another species to make that other species do things that it would simply otherwise not be able to do in nature. Is that a fair assessment?
That's true, yes.
Okay, so then this is something that we've never seen in nature, or have we?
Well,
the interbreeding of species.
The interbreeding of species actually occurs all the time out in nature. That's how species eventually evolve. That is, there are interactions among species. We can cross among species. In fact, virtually all the crops we grow now have been developed by making interspecific or interspecies crosses. That is, tomatoes, we have about 9 different species that are crossable with tomatoes, and we've used disease resistance, other types of nematode resistance.
What would be an example? What would we mate with a tomato that's not a tomato?
Well, when you say other species, that is, we have a hierarchy of taxonomy that above the species level is the genus level. So in the Solanum genus, which is the one that tomato is in, there are many species that exist in the wild, and some of which we're able to make crosses with.
Okay. Well, I guess
we've made a completely new species, triticale. So you may find the triticale grain in a health food store, which was completely created from crossing wheat and rye. Again, not with genetic engineering, but with standard crossing. The limitation of that is that you can't go too far. That is, outside the genus level, that is, once you get beyond, say, the cousin level, you simply can't do that. So we're limited in traditional breeding with traits that are available within the pool in which you can successfully make crosses. And so that does extend to other species, but it's limited
not to other, another, not to other genes, genotypes. And
genera, that is.
Genera.
In some
okay.
cases, even there. Most of the orchids you find in the market go even beyond that. That is, orchid breeders have gone even beyond the genera. The other place where we very commonly use the traits of the capabilities of two different species is in grafting. As you mentioned, gene grafting, which in fact we do, but virtually all of our fruit trees, citrus, nuts, grapes, all of these virtually utilize rootstocks that are of one species and the shoot, the scion, the part that produces the fruit, from a different species. So, and we've been doing this since the Roman days. So in fact, farmers have utilize the combined capabilities of multiple species for a very long time.
So let's turn to corn and BT corn, which is something that's very popular right now. And what we have done essentially, I think, is in taking the bacillus or genes from Bacillus thuringiensis and inserted them into the corn, correct?
That's right.
In a
one
way.
Gene. Essentially one or two genes.
One or two genes from Bacillus BT, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then inserted them into that 3-foot-long rope inside each molecule of the corn plant.
That's right.
So now a bug eats that corn and it dies.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Which means we don't have to spray an insecticide on the field or in the environment in order to stop them from feeding on the corn.
Okay. Now, this is a pretty neat thing, isn't it? I mean, if you're a farmer, this is a pretty darn good idea because it allows you to cut way back on a lot of other inputs. You don't have to spray pesticide all over the place or anything.
Well, I think it's spoken for by the fact that 88% of the corn grown in the U.S. Utilizes one form of genetic engineering or another, and particularly pesticide. You're right. That has greatly enabled farmers to cut back on their insecticide use.
Mm-hmm.
And had a recent study in the Midwest showed that those farmers and corn farmers who use that since its introduction have received about $2.5 billion in economic benefits. But even more importantly, farmers who did not use the GE corn received $4.5 billion of benefit because of the general reduction in the pest in the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
Those farmers didn't have to buy the seed, but they did get reductions in their pest control budgets. So the effect of reducing the overall insect prevalence in an area because of the use of these GE crops extends out beyond the users themselves.
Well, and similarly with genetically engineered soybeans, or soybeans that have been engineered to withstand the glyphosate herbicide, also help farmers too. Correct. I mean, one farmer can now grow like 1,000 acres of soybeans and not have a single weed. Having been a teenage herbicide myself, that's amazing stuff.
Well, it's been very effective, and the main benefit of it is it's been enabled farmers to use more conservation tillage. That is, less plowing.
Mm-hmm.
That is one way you control weeds. It's true we can control weeds with human hoeing, which is very expensive, and it's not a fun job if you've done it yourself. And it's allowed farmers to cut way back on the plowing, which has many benefits. Reduced soil erosion, carbon sequestration into the soil, higher organic matter. All of these things have been documented over the last 15 years that these are benefits that are coming to farmers. And that's why, again, over 90% of soybean farmers use these crops.
And why not? I mean, my goodness, think of the labor saving and all of the other things. So I bring this up because...
The other point is, you say, why not? The other advantage is that, in fact, as you mentioned, glyphosate is the most prevalently used herbicide in connection with those crops. By its adoption, it has displaced many other herbicides that potentially have a less compatible effect on the environment. That is, glyphosate is one of the safest agricultural chemicals we have. It doesn't really move in water. Its potential toxicity to anything other than plants is very, very, very low. So, in fact, we've received an additional benefit that we have had a holiday, if you will, from using other herbicides that were in use prior to the development of these crops.
And one more thing with respect to the benefits of genetically engineered crops before we move on to the meat of our show, as it were. I've seen tomatoes that don't leak anymore. You can take a ripe tomato now and slice it for a sandwich and put it between two pieces of bread and it doesn't leak.
That's one of the goals that have been strategized. I mean, if you think of a cherry tomato that has a really big locule and a big juicy seed cavity and you cut it in half, it's very hard to keep it as a slice. But that didn't involve genetic engineering. That's traditional breeding. There are no genetically engineered tomatoes on the market
right now. Oh, okay. I understood that it was, but if it isn't... But we can do all kinds of things with genetic engineering that we could not do before. And there we are now. Let's turn to whether these new inventions are safe to eat or not, because that really is the concern on the minds of those who have placed California's Proposition 37, the right to know about GMOs, on the ballot. Are they safe? If they're safe, why don't we want to know about them? This is The Food Chain. I am right back with Dr. Kent Bradford, and you do stay tuned. Well, folks, welcome back. Michael Olson here. It appears as though we've gone and lost our guest, so what we'll have to do is check back with him. Our guest today is Dr. Kent Bradford, PhD Director, Seed Biotechnology Center for UC Davis. And let's see, we have him here. Are you there, Doctor?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. I don't know what happened. We just clicked the wrong buttons. And sometimes that certainly happens, but now we have you. Folks, let's see. As Dr. Bradford said, 85% of our corn in the nation's food chain has been re-engineered to contain Bacillus thuringiensis, an organic pesticide. A bug goes and bites one of those corn plants and it croaks. That's it. No more bug. But I think 97% of our soybean crop now contains a foreign gene that allows us to spray those soybean plants with glyphosate herbicide, and it will kill all the weeds, but none of the soybean plants. So a significant, almost, gee whiz, a huge percent, 90% of the big crops in our food chain, with the exception of wheat, corn and soybeans, now contain foreign genes. So we're eating it. So the question are these genes safe, Dr. Bradford?
Absolutely.
There you go.
There's no evidence. There's no evidence at all that there's been any health or safety issues for humans or animals in the 16 years that these have been grown on a large scale. So, I mean, there is absolutely no evidence for that. And in fact, these foods have been much more intensively tested for safety than any of our other whole foods that are on the market.
Well, who tests them?
Well, they're tested by the companies that are developing them. That's true. They're tested extensively through requirements that are required by to meet certain criteria, and then those are reviewed by the FDA. The Food and Drug Administration, in the end, does have to rule on all genetically engineered crops.
People point at
it. Doesn't have to. Excuse me. It is the same case as it is with any other whole food. That is, the FDA. For no whole food guarantees its safety. That is, the FDA always says it's up to the manufacturer to have responsibility for the safety of their food. So for any whole food, the FDA simply says we have reviewed the data and we agree that this is safe. But they never actually verify that it is safe, and they don't require this for any whole food, but all of the genetically engineered crops that are in the market have gone through consultation and review by the FDA.
Okay, so then the people who make the the genetically engineered foods are required to test them or look at them or do something with them, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay.
And they've been tested far greater than any other whole foods that are on the market.
That's fair enough. And then they report to the FDA, correct?
They would submit a package, yes. They also submit the package to the USDA, the U.S. Department of Food and Agriculture, that examines them with respect to whether they will become a pest in the environment, that is, whether the plant has a potential to be a pest. And for the two that you mentioned that involve pest control, they are also reviewed by the Environmental Protection Agency. So in those two cases, three different agencies would have had to be satisfied before those crops could be commercially produced and sold.
Okay. Now, the people who have put this initiative on the California ballot, they point to the FDA and say, well, look who's running that place. It happens to be a guy named Michael Taylor who happens to be a Monsanto honcho. So it would appear that, and that's what they say, look at this. Who studies the safety efficacy of these crops are the people who manufacture them. And they send the reports to an FDA that's run by the industry. So do we believe that?
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization to say that Monsanto runs the FDA.
Okay.
I think to say that because somebody in their past history worked for a particular segment of an industry that they are still now in the government employ, somehow beholden to that. I think that besmirches the reputation of government workers. I mean, we have to assume that regulators are operating in the under the law and in the best interest of their clientele, which is all of us. So I think if you were to look through all of the employees in government and say no one who's ever worked for any private industry should work for government, that's going to be pretty interesting situation.
Well, I mean,
government people, for example, certifying bridges or something who had no engineering background.
I mean,
Amen
to
definitely
that.
Doesn't make sense.
Amen to that. Now, I'm just passing these things on because these are the points that people are raising, and I'm giving you the opportunity to respond to them.
Now, what
they say with respect to Michael Taylor was not only was he the one, not only did he used to work for Monsanto, but he was the one who essentially got the FDA to accept genetically modified foods on the basis of their substantial equivalence, which is to say, if an apple looks like an apple, it's an apple, regardless of what has been done inside the apple. And so
substantial equivalence means that the content of the food-related elements, as the nutritional content, the composition, and so on, has not been substantially modified. It's not that this one person makes that decision. That's an FDA standard in all cases. That is, the FDA has ruled that it is, in fact, misleading to consumers to put a label on something that is not there. That is, to put a label on something that says that does not, for example, you cannot label corn to say cholesterol-free, because corn never had cholesterol in it. That's misleading to consumers to try to label something or to try to say something about a food that is not there. So the FDA is constrained that if, in fact, there is no substantial compositional change in the food at any significant level, it's really not appropriate for a science-based regulatory agency to require labeling in those situations. Would we really want that? Would we really want our regulatory agencies to start labeling things that aren't there, that they cannot substantiate scientifically?
As a citizen,
I don't. I want my regulatory agencies to be operating on a solid scientific basis.
Yes, but the basis of that was sold to FDA by Michael Taylor of Monsanto that...
There's a whole agency working on this to say that one person did that is amazing.
And then you can rebut. This is what is being put on the table. They look at Michael Taylor and said he was the one that talked the FDA into accepting the doctrine of substantial equivalence, that said, in effect, that if you take the gene from one genera or whatever, one critter, and put it into the other, that there is no substantial difference.
I don't think we should put this on this person's head. There's over 400 studies around the world. There's 400 studies commissioned by the European Union itself that could find no health or safety issues with genetic engineering.
Okay.
The American Medical Association just this year said there is no scientific basis for labeling genetically engineered foods. So this is not about just the FDA. The entire scientific consensus around the world, even from places that really politically do not even like genetic engineering, cannot find any concrete evidence in the scientific literature to say that they are not safe. So I think the FDA is acting in accordance with the scientific consensus.
Fair enough.
So therefore, it doesn't really matter who the head of it is. They're acting on a scientific basis.
Okay, fair enough. And when we get back, let's talk with some of those other scientists, like Dr. Don Huber, that crazy little old guy who says there is a difference. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back with Dr. Kent Bradford and you. Well, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson today. We have Dr. Kent Bradford with us, Director of Seed Biotechnology Center, UC Davis. Oh my goodness, the work those folks do there is simply incredible with the development of our crops. And they do it in the conventional way, that like we've been doing for 10,000 years, and they also do it with the supercharger of genetic engineering, which is you take genes from one crop and put it into the other and make it do something that it would not otherwise do. And that's the subject today. The technology companies that manufacture genetically engineered foods all say these foods are perfectly safe. They test them themselves. They send the test to the United States government, Food and Drug Administration, USDA. Everybody's happy, except not everybody's happy. There are those who are standing up and saying, wait a minute, something's not right here. Among them, Dr. Don Huber, who is a professor emeritus at Purdue, a plant scientist who has studied the impact of glyphosate intensive soils and say that there's something happening there that's causing spontaneous abortion rates of 40 up to 45%. Another one, you don't have to look very far to find dissent. Irmakova, a leading scientist at the Institute of Higher Nervous Activity and Neuropsychology in Russia, tested soy on rats and found some really disturbing results. So not everybody is saying that they're safe. How do you respond to these dissident studies, Professor?
I guess I would characterize them as you say. They are dissidents. They're outliers. I think I have to ask your clientele, your listeners, if in fact the use of glyphosate was causing 45% abortion in animals, and yet we have been feeding our livestock, our cows, chickens, pigs, virtually all of our livestock is fed corn and soybeans. As you mentioned before, 90% of those are genetically engineered. Do you not think that our livestock producers would have noticed a 45% abortion rate in their animals?
Mm-hmm.
I find it inconceivable to think that after 15 years, trillions of servings, billions and billions of animals fed these crops, that something with that magnitude of effect would not have been noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that believable?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm just totally stumped, personally.
this is the type, again, scientists, we look at the facts. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but Mr. Huber's or Dr. Huber's results have been rejected by the American Phytopathological Association and other, even his own institution has disowned itself from his statements. Mm-hmm. So, if this is the type of data that the proponents of Proposition 37 believe are going to carry the day, well, I find that very sad that Proposition 37.
Do you think
Proposition 37 claims to be a consumer right to know, but in fact it's turning into an attempt to make people scared of their food. That is, it's not really about the right to know. It's an organized campaign to try to make people scared of food that is perfectly healthy and is having environmental benefits for us all.
Well, let me go back to Dr. Huber for a minute, because he has credentials.
I thought we were going to talk about Prop 37.
Okay.
Dr. Huber is a sideshow.
Okay.
I mean, he's really
okay.
An outlier in the whole
scientific
world.
Well, who's paying him off?
I don't know why he's doing this. I can't understand that. Who's paying off Dr. Joseph Merkula, who's one of the funders of Proposition 37?
See, I don't see anybody paying them off. I don't see anybody buying them.
Well, Dr. Merkula is selling sort of bogus food supplements on the web by scaring people about their food. He also happens to be one of the main funders of the Proposition 37 campaign. Why don't we talk about that?
Okay, why don't we? Again, I am a consumer. I don't know what's going on.
Well, why don't you pay attention to the National Academy of Science, the American Medical Association, the 400 or so papers that have been documented to show no health effects? Why would you pick one scientist out of Russia who you know not at all?
I don't know a retired scientist
from Illinois or Indiana who is complete outlier in the entire scientific community. Why would those be the ones we choose to talk about?
Because they sound reasonable, like you.
Again,
just
is
like
it
you,
reasonable? Is it reasonable again to say that 50% of the animals in our livestock system are subject to abortion, and that our livestock production system would not notice that? Is that reasonable?
Dr. Huber says they are noticing it.
Well, again, if that were the case, do you think that those livestock owners would still continue to buy the products such that it is supported by 90% of the farmers? Do you think the farmers would still be growing 90% of these crops and selling them to those livestock producers if, in fact, those livestock producers believed what Dr. Huber is putting out and were seeing that in their own results? I find that very unreasonable to believe.
Fair enough. Well, let's go to Proposition 37. We have to take a quick break, and we have so little time. And like I said, I wish I had talked with you about your work instead of Proposition 37, because the stuff that you are doing is so incredibly interesting to me, at any rate, that I hope that when our tempers cool down someplace down the line, we can have a conversation about your work with making our crops better. But
I'd be glad to tell you about some of the things we're doing that will be beneficial to everyone.
Well, I'm sure most of what you do will be beneficial to everyone. Now, when we come back, I have to ask you about Proposition 37. And you are a person who you're doing your best to make crops better using this technology of genetic engineering. If you are proud of your work, why not tell the world about it? We will be right back. Well, folks, 1 million Californians has signed up to an initiative that would require the labeling of foods that contain genetically modified organisms to be labeled as such. All kinds of big businesses are standing up, putting up $28 million to put that initiative down. And so today we ask, why not know about genetically modified organisms? And that's the question we have on the table with Dr. Kent Bradford, who is the director of Seed Biotechnology Center at UC Davis. So, you know, I look at the work that you folks are doing, and I just think that, wow, that's pretty amazing stuff. Why not stand up and proudly say, this is what we've got. Look at this wonderful crop. It contains our work in it. And why do you want to hide it?
Well, as I tried to explain before, there existing regulations say that if the content of a food is substantially changed, it would be labeled. That is, if the content of a nutrient or something is changed more than threefold, it would be labeled. So everything we have out there right now is substantially equivalent. But the key thing is it's not really up to those companies whether they're labeled or not. That's an FDA decision whether it's labeled. The issue with Prop 37 is that while it's presented as a simple labeling issue, this should be easy, there are many things hidden in there that are going to be very disadvantageous. That is, authorizing a whole new set of shakedown lawsuits that could be used to
back
pop
up.
Excuse me, I thought we were going to talk about 37, and I was
going to
be representative of the no on 37, and we've spent 55 minutes without actually pointing out all of the hidden problems that people will be voting for when they think they're just voting for a simple labeling law.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I just answer one question and I'll give you the rest of the time. Please tell me, if corn that contains Bacillus thuringiensis is not substantially different than corn that does not contain Bacillus thuringiensis?
It's not substantially different from a nutritional or food composition point of view. Organic growers organic growers can use the exact same BT protein and spray it on their plants up to the day of harvest.
Okay.
That means that people are probably eating the BT protein in organic produce as well. Do we need to label that?
I'm going to give you the rest of the time to tell us why we should not know about the GMOs in our food.
It's not about the GMOs in your food. What we get to vote on is the initiative that is placed before us. If the pro-37 people had just put a simple labeling bill on the initiative, that would have been fine. But no, they included an enforcement mechanism that it authorizes shakedown lawsuits by lawyers, as we've already seen with Prop 65. It exempted two-thirds of the food in the market. So if they're so concerned with consumers' right to know, why didn't they include those? They exempted a whole array of categories of food. They've brought in this whole thing about natural labeling, which looks very much like an opportunity to restrict the term natural only to organically certified foods. The Natural Foods Board recently came out against this proposition for that very reason. It's a very poorly written. It's crafted in a way that is only going to help the lawyers. It's going to be the right to sue, not the right to know. And people should know that. That is, when people think that they're going to be voting on just I should know what's in my food, nobody disagrees with that. The companies who make this food don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. What I disagree with is an initiative process that allows special interests to write a bill that contains a lot of negative hidden aspects that people are misled to vote for, and then the whole food industry suffers the consequences. This will not just impact those targets you'd like to point to, Monsanto and DuPont and so on. This will also hurt non-GM growers. It will stretch all the way back to farmers with burdensome regulation and lawsuits.
Those are the reasons
I'm against it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you all out there. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.